So the plan tonight was to continue our discussion of the Bible and its transmission, but after the lesson this morning, I thought we might just default to Jeff's job at the cemetery, because I really want to know more about that. I have known Jeff for 15 years. I did not know you were a grave digger.
They didn't trust me with the backhoe. The tractor incident especially.
Do y'all now understand some things better as a result of that? I mean, just things just suddenly made sense. I was on YouTube this past week, and in the search bar, I was typing in contradictions in the Bible, and YouTube actually didn't let me finish.
Helped you fill in?
It did. I thought was interesting that, you know, when YouTube thinks, I know where he's going, it kind of helps you out sometimes. And so it knew that that's what I was looking for. So the first three returns I got were first from a poster named Holy Kool-Aid, which probably tells you everything you need to know.
YouTube knows you too.
Yes. The first one was from a guy named a guy with the label Holy Kool-Aid. 12 contradictions in the Bible. The second video was 30 obvious Bible contradictions. And then Holy Kool-Aid reappeared with 13 more contradictions in the Bible.
You clicked on the first video.
No, I didn't.
You fed the algorithm.
I just looked at what came up, and that was the order it came up with. I did the same thing with Google, and the first result was from American Atheists. And I'll admit, I didn't actually open their website because I figured I knew where that one was going to go. So does that register with y'all? The significance of that. Think about one of our young people off at college, and maybe a friend has said something to them. And I know this isn't our impulse, because some of us are old enough that we have actually looked up numbers in the phone book. But but when our kids want data, what do? They Google it, right? Or more likely, they go to YouTube and look up a video, because you don't even have to read. You can just watch the video and collect the data. So I just want you to think about the fact that if they have a question about contradictions in the Bible, the very first material that these resources are going to feed them are resources that will question whether or not the Bible is the Word of God. So I just thought that was interesting, or in this case, more specifically, whether or not there were contradictions in the Bible. So I think it says something about kind of the cultural lean on this stuff right now.
Right.
And so if you're having questions about this, this is what the experts are going to weigh in and say. You know, there are all kind of contradictions in the Bible.
Well, and it is a very popular genre just in terms of, and that's one of the main strategies, I think, for young people at the pop culture level of tearing down the Bible. Just, you know, look at all these silly mistakes.
Deconstruction.
Yeah, it's like we've been talking about, you know with the manuscript variants and stuff that we talked about, you know, a time or two ago. But at the popular level, it's really not about the manuscript stuff. It's really about literally just open your own Bible and look at these apparent alleged contradictions within the Bible in your English translation.
So Jeff and I have been talking to you about this. This is our fourth session to deal with the Bible with a special focus on the transmission of the Bible. And one of the things that we hope you're picking up is that there's an awful lot that could be said about this. I mean, you could look back on some of the previous ones, even on the issue of transmission and, you know, how it's been copied down through time and those kind of things, and realize that we didn't begin to scratch the surface. You could go back and say, well, you know, you could have done a whole class on that. Yeah, right. And so when we come to this topic about contradictions, we will leave you dissatisfied tonight. Because there is a lot that could be said about all that. I just wanted you to carry that sense away, because I know one of the concerns, and you may want to weigh in on this too, that Jeff and I both have, is the danger of a disciple, especially a younger disciple, who's never encountered this stuff before or these questions before, or at least has never encountered a specific criticism, that when they get hit with it for the first time, the impulse is to think, nobody else knows about this, and there isn't an answer for this, and it undermines their faith. And so I wanted to go back and rehearse this thing you've heard Jeff and I say over and over again, because I doubt there's anything someone's going to say about the Bible that is new. Right.
Well, that's just part of it. I mean, part of it's just our lack of, you know, historical awareness. Any of these supposed contradictions, we're not talking about the manuscript stuff we've been talking about, we're just talking about open the Bible, its stories, its facts, its figures. Any of these alleged contradictions, you know, these have been noticed for, you know, a couple thousand years, I mean, so to speak, through the commentaries. You know,
right.
We forget other cultures, other languages, other people of other eras. They've been reading the Bible all the way through, too. So, you
it's
know,
been around a long time.
Yeah, so just because some young or new or rapidly popular YouTube influencer, internet influencer, is now saying, hey, this contradiction just blows everything up, the contradiction itself isn't even new. It's just new to you. And that's the biggest thing we always want our young people to realize is, as some of you have heard me quote an old professor of mine, just because it's new to you doesn't mean it's new to me, is what he used to say. And his whole point was just to remember, when, especially when we're young, we think that, you know, we just found this, you know, key that unlocks all the, you know, everything you knew was, you know, everything you always thought you knew was false.
Right.
Because there is a certain, as Paul taught us, there is a certain arrogance in knowledge or apparent knowledge, or we think we know something that others don't know, we've discovered something new. That's kind of, that makes our egos feel good. And so, you know, we need to be very careful with what we're listening to, especially when it seems like it's new or shocking.
The other thing is that I think it's frightening when someone raises a question about something as fundamental as the Bible, and we don't know how to handle it.
Right.
We don't know how to respond to it.
Right.
And they show us something, we think, oh, well, wait, those two things don't agree. That's a conflict in the Bible. And it's frightening to think, oh no, what maybe what I believe about that isn't true. And so one of the things I know Jeff and I struggle with is how to communicate, especially to young people, that that you shouldn't be freaked out about that.
Right.
Because that's all it is. It's just new to you.
That's exactly right.
Very little of what we talked about hasn't been around for a long, long time, discussed many times. That's going to be true of the contradictions that we look at tonight.
Yeah.
Been around a long time.
None of these, even if you just found out about them on YouTube, you know, if Holy Kool-Aid tipped you off to this week, you know, none of these are new. People have noticed these for centuries and millennia. There's nothing new about any of these alleged contradictions.
And still believe the Bible, by the way.
And because there are answers and solutions. Because part of the key, and I think we'll get to this at some point, is number one, you got to be careful what you actually mean by that
right.
word contradiction anyways. So.
Well, that is something we need to dig into tonight. So I think what we want to do is just to make some observations tonight about this criticism of the Bible, that it's loaded with contradictions. And listen, the accusation is way more than 13 or 30, right?
Yeah.
You can read some sources that'll say there are thousands and thousands of contradictions. They're all the way through the Bible. It's something that people say all the time. And what we'd really like to do is kind of give you a framework for processing these rather than start walking through all of them. By the way, if you're concerned about one that someone has raised with you and we don't get to it tonight, go ahead and text it in, and we will be glad to try to do a future text talk and cover that. This is our last planned text talk, but we'll talk about this for as long as y'all feel like we need to.
On this subject.
Yes. I'm sorry. Thank you for correcting me on that. We will have future text talks, just probably not about the transmission of Scripture. Maybe. Unless you guys have more questions. We'll spend as much time on this as we need to so that we adequately deal with anything you guys have on your mind. So with regard to contradictions, observation number one, you rarely encounter an alleged contradiction that changes the basic story.
And the significance of the basic story.
And the significance of the basic story. Do you guys understand what we mean when we say that? You rarely encounter a contradiction that changes anything about the fundamental story. For example, people do this all the time. And this will be interesting since we're reading two of the Gospels this year, and if you squeeze Mark in, three of them. People do this with the Gospels. They will read Matthew, and they will read Mark, and they'll find the same incident recorded, especially Matthew, Mark, and Luke, often record the very right. same incidents, and the stories are different. And that will say, well, wait. Matthew said it was this way. Mark said it was that way. They contradict each other. The Bible's not true, and we shouldn't trust it, right?
Right.
That's the simple process of how that goes. But if you'll pay attention, very often those criticisms are about little tiny things in the story, little details of the story, not the big story.
Yeah, if we want to be, you know, honest, you know, the words that come to mind with these kind of alleged contradictions are quibbling or pedantic. In other words, you're missing the point by quibbling, in one sense, quibbling over, you know, whether there were two or four, or were they coming or going, or just whatever. The point is something big happened. And literally the incidentals of which direction or how many bystanders, you're missing the point of the story. And again, we're doing this for sake of argument. You know, we both agree that, you know, there actually are decent solutions to a lot of these alleged, you know, contradictions. But just for sake of argument, you know, people are quibbling in the details while, you know, they're straining out the gnat to swallow the camel, to steal a phrase of Jesus.
Well, I think what makes that useful is it raises a question that needs to be asked of the critic, right? Mm-hmm. Because if the critic wants to pick apart the little details of timing or number or things
right.
like that,
right.
well, he needs to deal with the fact that all the gospel writers tell us that Jesus came into the world.
Right.
All of them tell us that he lived and preached and worked miracles. All of the writers tell us he faced violent opposition, ultimately, that put him to death by the hands of the Romans. And all of the writers tell us that he was raised from the dead. The fundamentals of the story, they all agree on.
Right.
Right?
And thus the significance of this story, you know, I mean, you know, the bottom line is, you know, whether it was, you know, how many baskets were picked up after a miracle of, you know, how many baskets of food were picked up. The point is he multiplied loaves and fishes
right.
and there was stuff left over. You're missing the point when you try, keyword, to quibble on these details.
Yeah, well, and I do think, don't hear us say that the details don't matter.
Correct.
Okay, that's not
Correct.
What we're saying. But it does raise an issue for the critic who wants to say, you have to throw everything aside. Well,
right.
wait, we're dealing with eyewitnesses. And so if all the details from one writer's account don't align with the details of another writer's account, you still have the fundamental story there.
Right.
What does the critic do with that, right? That they're all completely consistent on the big elements of the story. Give you an illustration of that to see if this clicks in your mind. So imagine you're standing with me and Jeff out at the covered drive-thru out there after services, and there's an accident out on the road, right? And we all witness the accident. And so when the police arrive, there's some dispute about who was at fault. And so they come over, realize some of us has witnessed it. They separate us. And they question us. Let's say there are five of us who saw it, and they ask us what we saw. Do you think there would be any discrepancies in the testimony? Why? Not because any of us are lying, but because when five people witness the same thing, even moments later, our stories differ because we perceive different things. For example, if that accident happened to involve a vintage Mustang, that's all I'm going to know about it. A Mustang was wrecked. It was horrible. I may not recover from it, right? Because that is just the greatest car ever. I wouldn't perceive anything else, right? It would influence my perspective on that. Think about this. Jeff says there was a white car in the accident. David Pickup says it was a gray car in the accident.
An accident still happened.
yeah, well, I mean,
and the vintage car was destroyed for your sake.
Yes, thank you. That's all. It was all that was important. Or one of the cars had three people in it, and someone else says, well, I only saw the driver. You see how all that could happen, right? Nobody's being dishonest. Just from your angle, how you looked, all that, it affected how you perceive the story. And that's, thank you, you gave the punchline away, but that's exactly right. Nobody would say, oh, wait, These statements differ. So there wasn't an accident, right? Nobody would say that. That would be absurd. And so my point about that is that you've still got to come back to whatever you decide about the details that some argue don't align. You still have to deal with what does align. Jesus came, Jesus died, Jesus rose. Still got to deal with that. Now, let's move on to a second observation, and I think this one's important because some of this is just about the nature of eyewitness testimony, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to explore that a little bit because sometimes when you're dealing with eyewitnesses, as I was talking about gray car, white car, two occupants, three occupants, you all were kind of nodding your heads because you're saying, yeah, I could see how there might be different perceptions of all of that. And sometimes we run into the same kind of thing when we deal with the gospel accounts. We deal with perception. So I want to give you an example of an alleged contradiction. Later this year, we will read from Matthew 20. If you look at Matthew 20, down in verse 29, there's a story about two blind men that are healed by Jesus, okay? And Mark and Luke also tell that story, but their accounts are different, and it's clearly the same story. I don't think there's any doubt about
right.
that, right?
Yeah.
There are times where there's more than one blind guy healed, and it might be a different story, and that's why the accounts differ. But I think everyone's generally in agreement that in Mark 10, in verse 46, there's the same story, and in Luke 18, verse 35, there's a story. Except in Mark's account, Mark doesn't talk about two blind men. He talks about one, and he names him Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the road. And Luke just says, a certain blind man. What do you think the critics say about that? It's a contradiction, right? How could that be true? It's either one or it's two, but both of those cannot be true. So the Bible is filled with contradictions and we just have to cast it aside. It can't be trusted.
Right.
So what do we do with that?
You're looking at me. So what?
I'm offering to let you in.
Oh, thank you.
Good lecture.
So what you do with that, number one, is you realize that difference doesn't mean contradiction necessarily.
See, that's important.
That's the key. I mean, again, it goes back to what we said earlier. Part of this is we got to be careful how we use these words and what we mean by these words. You know, and a lot of times when people start talking about contradictions, they're using it rather recklessly.
Correct.
And the truth of the matter is we're really just talking about is the accounts are different. Contradiction means cannot be reconciled in any way, shape, or form. There is no possible, and that's the key, no possible way of reconciling these two statements. And the truth of the matter is these are just different accounts. They're not contradictory accounts because you can give a reasonable explanation for why these different ways of describing what happened that day are what they are between the two blind men, the blind man named Bartimaeus, and a certain blind man.
Yeah, well, let's explore that a little bit. Why would Matthew say there are two, but Mark says there was one blind guy? Well, he didn't say one. He says there was a blind guy named Bartimaeus.
Well, see, and that's the key, right? You actually gave the game away right there when you said Mark doesn't say one. That's the key. To identify, when Mark identifies one particular, he's not ruling out there were other guys. He just wants you, the way he tells the story, he wants you to focus on Bartimaeus. Just like, for instance, if you're talking about your car accident, you know, we're all witnesses, a bunch of us are witnesses to a car accident. For me to talk about the driver to the police does not mean there were no passengers. For instance,
right.
to focus on a detail does not exclude the possibility of others. So right there, just between on the Matthew and Mark versions, there's no inherent contradiction. There's just a difference.
Yeah, well, and my guess is that maybe Mark knows Bartimaeus.
It's quite possible.
Or maybe Mark's audience knows who this guy is.
Well, and to that point, there's clues elsewhere in Mark's gospel that he's name-dropping for the sake of his arguments. Like when he mentions, you know, Rufus and Alexander, you know, and connects them to Simon of Cyrene in Mark chapter 15. Same type of, why would he do that? That probably because, quite possibly because his readers could then go back and talk to those men as further, you know, witnesses or aware of eyewitness testimony to further, you know.
Yeah, Mark and Luke don't say one and only one.
Correct.
They only mention one, and there may be reasons. For example, and I say this just because I think we do the same thing. So if Jeff is going to lunch with his plumber and there's a wreck.
There's a lot of car accidents tonight, man.
I just wanted to keep it simple. Work with the same figure. And so I say to Sean on Wednesday night, hey, Jeff was in a wreck this week. Did I lie? Did I misrepresent it? Why would I say to Sean, Jeff was in a wreck this week? Because he knows Jeff and not the plumber, right? And so for me and Sean, the plumber's not important to the story. Jeff is important. See how much we care about you?
I appreciate that.
You need to be honored. Y'all, does that make sense to y'all? We tell the story that way. Although I don't think if Sean later finds out that the wreck involved a plumber who was with Jeff.
Your story falls to pieces.
Yes, yes, yes. Now, or there wasn't a wreck at all.
Or you're dishonest or untrustworthy.
It just doesn't make any sense. Do y'all get that? And so I think we have to give that same room to the gospel writers. When they're sharing their accounts. And by the way, this is the way it is with eyewitness testimony, isn't it?
Sure. No, I mean, yeah, go ahead.
It's often what the details included reflect the writer's perspective and his purpose.
Right.
And so he may have a reason for focusing on Bartimaeus and not the other man involved.
No, I think that's exactly right, you know, because part of, I think, one of the takeaways in this, when we look at, you know, the way the critics, and we're using this example here right now with Bartimaeus, but when the critics, you know, try to promote or these alleged contradictions, part of what happens is, ironically, it's actually an example of not reading very carefully. Because what happens is when you read each gospel account on its own merits, you know, each gospel writer has a different emphasis, a different focus, he's telling the story to try to get you to notice something different. To your point about, you know, the why you tell Sean, you know, only about my part in the wreck and not the plumber's part, is because you want Sean to take something away that somebody we both know has been injured or is involved in a car wreck. Every one of these gospel writers is up to something that's not the same, quite the same as the others. They're not trying to lie or distort, but everybody, in a story so large, the enormity of God became flesh, dwelt among us, died on the cross for your sins, and was raised to a qualitatively different kind of life on the third day, and then ascends back into heaven. You know, that's an enormous story that has a lot of meaning and significance to be teased out of it in the different ways you tell the story. So part of it is just we're not, because we are, the modern mindset, we want to just boil it down to just the facts, sir. We want to strip mine the Gospels of their narrative story quality and turn them into just a brute slog through specific facts, and we miss the meaning. The Gospels are more concerned about the meaning and arranging the facts to accomplish certain meanings. The truth of this, we all just need to read better, but that starts with the critics who think they're on to something.
I want to tag on the end of that, because sometimes the reason one writer includes a collection of details is to serve his purpose.
Yep.
But then we go over and we read another writer's account, and he adds to the story, doesn't change it, but gives us a bigger picture of it.
Yeah.
As he writes from his perspective, and I've heard Doyle Moyer talk about these undesigned coincidences.
Yeah.
I think Susan read a book about that. I was talking about it online recently. But the fact that actually when you start putting the accounts together, you get a clearer picture of the story. I was just thinking about the rich young ruler story because I preached on that recently. Only one account says that Jesus looked at him and loved him.
Yeah.
But isn't that a critical detail in the story? And yet only one of the writers adds that piece, but it fills out the whole story and the whole account. So I think that's useful to keep in mind, that each of these writers has a perspective and a purpose that makes their account unique, and it doesn't exactly follow the other guy. By the way, if they're all going to tell the story exactly the same way with exactly the same details, why would we need four Gospels?
That's exactly right. It's four perspectives.
Yes.
It's not meant to be, again, a courtroom legal testimony, the way we want to think about it. It is meant to be four different perspectives, again, on an enormous event that defies human comprehension, ultimately.
Which I'm glad you brought up a courtroom, because...
Did I get ahead again?
No. It was a perfect segue. Well done. What does a court do when you have two or three witnesses that say exactly the same thing as they give their testimony? Yeah.
Collusion.
Yes. We look at those guys with suspicion and say, it sounds like they got together and got their story straight. Mm-hmm. So what would we be saying about the Gospels if every one of the writers told it exactly the same way, used the exact same verbiage every time, every place? Someone would say, well, you know, these are just, one guy wrote all four and put his four different names on it.
Right.
You know, it would also stir suspicion that way. So we need to clarify something, because I've got a couple of questions that popped up.
Okay.
Someone said, if the Bible writing is directed by the Holy Spirit, would you expect contradiction? And how do you explain the gospel contradictions when those gospels are inspired? So let's be clear. We're talking about the alleged contradictions of the critics, okay? Even in the details, Jeff and I believe the writers got it right, okay? The point we were making at the beginning of this was, even if you want to quibble about the details, the fundamentals are
right.
The same.
You're missing the point of the story and chasing, you know, these alleged contradictions. Yeah, you and I are in agreement that there are no actual contradictions.
Yes.
So that was an argument giving the critics a moment to just say, look, you're still missing the point.
Push back on the critics, right?
Yeah.
So Jeff and I don't believe there are contradictions in the details. We believe all those alleged contradictions can be ironed out. Someone also said, sounds like people are looking for a reason not to believe.
Oh, no, one of my big, this has gotten stronger with me the older I've gotten and the longer I've done this. I always go back to, in some of these moments, John chapter 3, you know, later in that conversation, Jesus and Nicodemus, you know, the judgment of the world, that basically people love darkness rather than light because their deeds were, you know, the bottom line, what Jesus was saying and what John was saying and recording that in his gospel is that ultimately it's not about more evidence or more facts. It's just people looking for excuses and loopholes. And we don't like that because we don't like to judge other people's hearts. And in one sense, only God can judge hearts. I get that. But what the Bible clearly teaches, there's a number of other passages we could go to, is that ultimately, you know, God is testing our will to believe, not our ability to believe in these kinds of things. And so to your point, you know, the Gospels are, you know, we have four Gospels. They're different, not contradictory, but different. People say contradiction. If everything was exactly the same, number one, we'd say, why are there four? And then number two, we'd say collusion. In other words, for the mind that is already disposed to look for the loophole, to look for the doubt, to look for the quibble, so that they don't have to bow their head and bend their knee, then, you know, God tests hearts as much as he tests minds. And that's just a hard thing for us to accept. But there's a number of passages, especially in the New Testament, that teach that.
Yeah, if I could tag on the end of that.
Please do.
I believe that in life, there are two kinds of people. There are people who are looking for answers, and there are people that are looking for questions. And everyone has to decide what kind of person they're going to be, because I think you find what you're looking for. And so I've studied with some people over the years that would ask questions, and I would try to give them what I thought were good answers. And when I finished, they wouldn't disagree. They would say, yes, but. And so I would answer that question. And then they would say, yes, but. And then there'd be a third question. And after about 3 or 4 months of studying with someone like that, it dawns on me, they're not looking for answers. They're just looking for the next question.
And to that point, you know, David, I think, you know, what you just said reminds me of a line from the Apostle Paul, when he talks about people always learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. You know, because, in other words, there's a type of person that simply does, you know, it will never be enough because they're looking for questions, not answers. Always learning, never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. That's a frightful line.
Very sad. Now somebody posed a really good question that it's unrelated to what we were just saying, but I want us to just touch on this real quick before we move on. They ask if it would be good, if there could be value in the videos like I mentioned at the beginning, where people argue that the Bible contradicts itself. Would there be value in sitting down and going through those with young people and helping them work through the questions that are there? And I think that is an outstanding idea. The high school kids here know that we frequently do that in Bible class. We'll grab some YouTube videos where someone makes an argument against some aspect of faith, and then we go back and work through it together. But remember, We get very little time with your young people in Bible class. And so I would encourage you as parents, take your kids to YouTube, show them the wrong stuff that's there, and show them that you know it's there, and study it and talk about it together. I would point out there are also videos that argue in favor of the truth and provide evidence for what is true. And I think kids need to get very familiar with that stuff as well. Greg Kokel has some excellent videos. He's an apologist. William Lane Craig is also an excellent apologist. They've got videos out there that they're worth kids getting familiar with that deal with some of these fundamental issues. So, yes, I think you should do it. I know it might be intimidating to think I'm showing my kids a video of someone who's teaching something not true. Trust me, they're going to find those anyway. It's better to find them together and know how to process them than to let a kid find them on his own in his dorm room after a professor's tried to undermine his faith.
And you know, Dave, along that line, I think one of the things that you and I have both tried to emphasize to our young people and to their parents as well over the years is, especially as young people grow up, you know, many of them leave for college, military, or whatever life takes them after they graduate high school around here. What we want our young people to always remember here as they leave Kleinwood and go out into the world and into their adult lives is, they may not remember all the specifics we taught them, you know, what the answer to this contradiction or alleged contradiction or whatever is. We want them to remember this is a place where we talk about these things. All honest questions are good questions that we want to talk about. And so if nothing else, whenever they run into something that troubles them, concerns them, confuses them, we want them, if nothing else, call home. Call one of us. Call one of the elders. But this is a place that we talk about these things. And again, just because it's new to somebody who's young does not mean it's new to those of us who are older. Please talk to us before you before you drink the holy Kool-Aid.
This would be a good place to say this again. I really do hope that y'all get sick of me saying this. I hope y'all do get sick of it too. This is a safe place to ask questions for everybody. This is a safe place to ask questions, okay? Even if it's fundamental and basic, it's okay. Ask any question that you're struggling with. We want to help with that. All right, observation number three. Sometimes things appear to be contradictions because we are unfamiliar with the cultural setting or the circumstances or the languages being used in a text. And this story back with Bartimaeus and the fellow blind guy,
right,
is an example of that. So if you look back at Matthew 20, Matthew's account of it in verse 29 says that this miracle happened as Jesus was leaving Jericho.
Right.
Okay? So as he's leaving, he sees the two blind guys, heals them. Mark says, same thing. This happened as he was leaving. Luke is the problem. Luke says the miracle took place as they were approaching the city of Jericho. Now let's just pause for a second and notice what the quibble is over. What's your fancy word for that? They're being pedantic. I want to get familiar with that word.
I don't think that's a fancy word.
I can do it. I recognize that. We're dealing with little detail stuff here, right? There was a miracle. Blind guys were healed, but hey, Luke said it happened when he was coming to Jericho, and Matthew says it was as he's leaving Jericho. It's contradiction, and so
throw it all out.
You got to throw it all out, right? So how would you resolve that? I mean, it can't be, well, I guess it could be both ways. That's not really true, is it?
Well, there could have been it's going to be both ways.
There could have been a miracle going in, and there could have been a miracle coming out, which is at least within the scope of possibility.
Yeah, for starters, that's exactly how it's not like just, you know, holy Kool-Aid or contemporary influencers or skeptics are just noticing this stuff. You know, this has been noticed for centuries. So
right.
It's not like, you know, nobody's thought about this before until, you know, holy Kool-Aid or whoever's, you know, sitting there one day reading their Bible for skeptical purposes and saying, ah, look at this.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. So, yeah, I mean, other, you know, suggestions. You know, one is just maybe he passed them, you know, once going one way, once going the other. I mean, just, you know, differences don't mean contradictions automatically.
I will admit that years ago when I found that for the first time, it was very unsettling to me. I thought, okay, why why going in and why going out? Why isn't it the same? And one of the things I didn't realize is that there are two Jericho sites.
Well, see, that's going back to you got to know their world and not assume it's our world.
That's exactly right. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But evidently there's a new city of Jericho by the time Jesus is on earth that's been built down the road from the old one, but still the ruins of the old site that you pass by. And so the question is, does Luke perhaps have in mind the site of the ancient city as we were passing by and leaving the old ruins of Jericho, we encountered these men. So it's somewhere between the old and the new that this encounter takes place.
See, if you flew, you'd know this because over in Israel today,
I don't know how that connects.
It's still that way today, man. There's the mound of ancient Jericho and there's the current city of Jericho.
Can you imagine a picture of that we could put on the slide?
Oh, sorry. That's, wow. Okay. Touche.
I had a picture for your slide this morning too, but I didn't mention that.
But yeah, but the bottom line is yes. I mean, there are. I mean, to this day, you go over there. There's a mound that is the ancient Joshua's city of Jericho, and then there is another settlement that built up in the vicinity of it, but is not the same as the mound.
And so there's at least a possibility that Luke just has a different angle on that. That in his mind, he's thinking about that spot of that old city.
Yeah.
And Matthew and Mark are thinking about the new city.
Yeah.
And by the way, can you see that? You see somebody having a different perspective and looking at it from a different way. And let me just add, evidently this is not a problem for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Because frankly, guys, if this is a fraud, if the Bible's a fraud as the critics claim, don't you think they would have cleaned that up? Hey, Luke. You didn't get the Jericho story right, okay? Go back and edit that, fix that. Or a scribe, because you know the scribes, according to critics, are always messing with the text.
Yeah.
Would have easily made that correction. Why didn't they? This is an easy fix.
But by the way, David, since we're using kind of modern, kind of current modern illustrations, how many of you have ever given directions to somebody and there's been confusion over the directions? Because I meant where the restaurant used to be, not with its new location. I mean, right? That's what you meant. I mean, just we sometimes confuse ourselves and give directions where they used to live, that house in their old neighborhood. Oh, okay, I thought you meant, their new house. This happens all the time when we give directions to people and just one of us is talking in one idiom, one of us is talking in another idiom about things that have moved or changed over time, especially if you lived in a city or a town for a long time. Things change, and one person may be talking about the way it used to be, one person may be talking about the way it is now, and that's where the confusion about giving directions to somebody comes from. We still do this today.
I think that I think that there are several possible explanations, which comes back to the definition of a contradiction.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
A contradiction is when you have two statements made that both cannot be true.
Right, and are ultimately unreconcilable.
Unreconcilable.
Not potentially unreconcilable, ultimately. There are no possible answers to this.
Jesus rose from the dead, he didn't rise from the dead.
Yeah, it's one or the other, and there's no distance between those that you can fix that.
Yeah. Let's deal with one other, and I don't know if it's fair to call this a contradiction, but this came up about the Bible reading last week, and Jeff and I wanted to mention it tonight. So go back to Matthew 2. Y'all may remember, if you were here on Wednesday 2 weeks ago, that Brian did a Wednesday night talk about the prophecies in Matthew 2, because we've been making our way through this segment of Matthew's gospel at the beginning of the year. And one of the prophecies mentioned at the end of the gospel, of chapter 2 rather, at the very end, verse 23, it says that they came to the city called Nazareth. This was to fill what was spoken through the prophets. He shall be called a Nazarene. And so we read that, and our impulse is to think, okay, somewhere in the Old Testament, there is a prophecy that says Jesus was going to be called a Nazarene. Problem.
Allegedly.
That prophecy doesn't exist.
Right.
There is no Old Testament prophecy. Isaiah doesn't say somewhere back there, tucked in some passage we haven't found yet, that Jesus was going to be called a Nazarene. So contradiction, problem, claim that wasn't true. What do we do with this text? where Matthew tells us by the Holy Spirit,
right,
this was a prophecy, and yet we can't seem to account for that.
Yeah, this is, I think, an example of where we have to read very carefully what Matthew is saying and not assume what Matthew is saying. And so first of all, you look at how Matthew has phrased it, you know, it's prophets plural. He's not talking about one particular place. And just to give you an example, in context, when Matthew wants to talk about one particular prophet and one specific prophecy, just earlier in chapter 2, you know, then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah, and he cites a particular text. When Matthew wants a particular prophet and a specific prophecy, he can cite it that way. That's not what he does here, because what he's doing is something different than quoting a specific, one specific prophecy from one specific prophet. He's talking more in the conceptual realm, what the prophets talked about. And so there's a couple different directions this works. And this, you know, we read, once it's, and this may sound wrong, we read almost too literally, going back to, we're looking, we want, you know, two versus one. Well, if I focus on the one, doesn't mean there weren't two, you know, these quibbles. Part of what Matthew is doing is at least one of these two distinct possibilities. One is, again, he didn't write this in English. He's writing this in Greek based on Aramaic, based upon Hebrew. And so in their languages, there's a potential wordplay here, because Jesus was called the branch in Isaiah chapter 11. And in Hebrew, the word for branch there in Isaiah 11 sounds a lot like the word for Nazareth. And so he's punning. He's not looking for a specific prophecy. He's punning off of, in their languages, you know, very witty-like. Because again, it's not like earlier in chapter 2 where he has one specific passage, one particular prophet in mind. What the prophet said, there's going to be a root, a branch from Jesse. And even though Isaiah's word, Natsar, there, sounds like Nazareth, you know, that's one angle. The other possibility is this, that again, he's talking about a theme or an idea, and that is that he'd be a Nazarene. Well, Nazareth was a byword. That was, you know, John emphasizes that, you know, right? In John's gospel, any good thing comes from Nazareth.
Insult.
It was an insult. Nazareth, even among the Galileans, you know, it was still bad to be from Nazareth. Nazareth was nowhere. And so the idea of to be called a Nazarene was just simply to be despised, to be rejected. And so it's more already tapping into a theme that Matthew himself will develop later in other chapters about the despised nature of Jesus' roots, his upbringing, his Galilean background, that he's punning off of the whole, to be a Nazarene is to be despised or rejected. Remember what Isaiah 53 says? Again, what the prophet said? You know, no form that we should desire him. He will be despised and rejected of men. And so Matthew's not worried about a specific place in the prophets. He's punning off of a particular theme in the prophets. That's why it's plural, and there's no specific thing. And the last thing I'm going to add about this is, if you're reading it in Greek, when Matthew wants to quote a particular prophet, he phrases it a certain way normally, that he doesn't phrase it that way here. So part of the problem is when a critic, a YouTube influencer, is reading this in English, is looking for loopholes, doesn't care to actually read it carefully, does not care to read it culturally, historically, or linguistically, he thinks he's got a gotcha moment. When the fact of the matter is, you need to read Matthew more carefully and read Matthew on his own terms.
And sometimes, going back to the broader context of Matthew 2, with, I think there are five citations.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch in Matthew 2.
In chapter 2.
Correct.
Matthew, is, I think, teaches us that it isn't as simple as we want to make it to be, that here is a prophecy, and this is the direct fulfillment of it. Sometimes
yes,
it's like that. Sometimes, though, it appears the Holy Spirit isn't saying this is that, but he's saying this is like that, or you got a similar circumstance
yeah,
to that. And part of it may just be that we need to broaden our understanding of how New Testament writers use Old Testament prophecies.
Yeah, just as a tag onto that, I mean, the fancy word for this is typology, and it's actually yeah, a far more common form in the New Testament of how prophecies are fulfilled than we realize.
Right.
And so again, because we, our modern mindset, we want one-to-one ratios, we want one-to-one correspondences, a specific prophecy fulfilled only and specifically in Jesus. And the truth of the matter is, all four Gospels, in very subtle ways, are saying not just Jesus fulfills specific prophecies, but Jesus embodies particular themes. You know, Jesus is the Passover lamb, and things like that. Mm-hmm. Themes, not just one specific prophecy in one place for all time, but a whole conceptual world coming out of the Old Testament that he embodies in a certain way. He's another Moses. He is another David. He is, you know, and so on it goes. Typology is far more common in the New Testament than we realize. And so Matthew just assumes you know what he's doing. We're the ones who are missing what Matthew is doing.
I think that might need to be a whole text talk in and of itself, to explore the New Testament writers' use of the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And maybe that might help us some
sure.
with that. One other thing, got about 5 minutes left. I wanted to give you another example that I encountered this week and or last week in prepping for this. One critic pointed to this in the Bible as an example of a contradiction. The Ten Commandments say, thou shalt not kill. And yet throughout the Old Testament, there are examples of God ordering his people, like Saul and Amalek, to go and kill and destroy. So on the one hand, it says, do not kill. On the other hand, God orders his people to kill.
Yeah.
And so there we have a contradiction, right?
Allegedly.
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 Well, I actually think that's silly. Mm-hmm. It's got more of a moral view component to it.
It's assuming the answer in the way it phrases the question or frames the issue, which is a problem.
I think probably all of us sitting here see the problem with that argument. All ending of life is not the same, right? We understand that. It's one thing by violence or in anger or revenge
right.
To go kill somebody.
Right.
And it's another thing for someone to be executed as a judicial punishment.
Right.
Both in life, they're not the same thing.
Well, just simply, I mean, just even in English, you know, forget, you know, Greek and Hebrew and the Bible's languages, just in English, we have a word kill and we have a word murder. Because we recognize in our own language, in our own culture, that there are differences, and that's why we have different words. And so sometimes we play word games with the Bible a little bit, you know, and we don't recognize that the Bible itself makes this a distinction between murdering somebody under certain circumstances and killing somebody under different circumstances. Just like in English, we have two different words because we recognize there are two different concepts at play.
And by the way, God has a right to define his terms.
And God,
I mean, he is God.
Yeah. Well, and this goes back to some of you, know, one of your favorite points at the end of the day, just when we talk about, a good God or I can't believe in a God who would, you know, allow, you know, whatever. Well, that may be your moral qualms about it, but that doesn't prove that there can't be an all-powerful being. I mean, we always just got to go back to number one, God can do whatever God pleases if he's really God, just as a, you know, starting place. We forget that.
I wanted to bring that one up, not because I think it's remarkable. I will be plain with you and say, I think that one's kind of silly. I think it's pretty easy to see through it. I think it's just about someone's moral objection to any kind of taking a life, even judicially.
Well, and I'll just add on, because in Hebrew, there are multiple words for killing, and some mean murder, some mean killing. I mean, just like in English. That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
But I wanted to mention that this alleged contradiction for a reason. When someone says, there are hundreds and hundreds of contradictions in the Bible, will you bear in mind that this is the kind of thing on their list? I'm not saying there are not some spots where it's difficult and we may need to struggle and study to figure something out. I'm not saying they're all this way, but I am saying that some of these alleged contradictions are allegedly like, absolutely like this. They're just silly. And that's how they're building their list. Don't get intimidated by the list of hundreds and hundreds of thousands and thousands. This is the kind of thing we're talking about. Just the silly stuff.
Right.
And frankly, guys, let me go back to something we said a minute ago. We'll wrap up with this. If the Bible is what they claim it is, if it's a fraud that's being hoisted upon us, my question is, why didn't they clean this stuff up?
Yeah, ironically, going back to scribes mess with manuscripts.
Well, and that's one of their accusations.
Yeah, you know? Right, right.
Why, even in the New Testament days, if they're trying to perpetrate a fraud,
yeah,
and these are, according to the critics, so obvious and glaring, why wouldn't you have gone back and ironed all that out if you want to perpetrate this lie that critics believe they're creating? Obviously, the New Testament writers didn't see a problem with these things that we encounter.
Nor did the majority of the scribes who kept, you know, copying and passing these on from generation to generation over the centuries of the transmission process. They were reading it because they were copying it.
Right.
You know, you copied Mark last month, you're copying Luke this month, you know this stuff. And yet they don't, you know, outside of a few exceptions, you know, which we've caught, you know, there wasn't tampering with the text because they didn't think these were fundamentally contradictions.
Right. So here's the deal. If you guys have other ones you'd like us to explore, we'd be happy to do that. If you've got questions that did not get adequately answered about this topic or anything related to the Bible, Jeff and I absolutely want to hear that. Be glad to do some more work in that if that'd be helpful to you. Thanks for coming tonight.